Hello and welcome to Bookmiss with me, Jo Maddox.
And me, Alice Evans.
And today we are joined remotely by artist and poet Stephen Emerson. Hi, Stephen.
Hello. How are you doing? Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We are in a very sunny autumnal Oxford. Where in the world, Stephen, are you?
I am I'm about 3 miles outside of Hastings in a static caravan at the top of a valley, looking out over ancient oak and sycamore and hawthorn and a few sheep and some crows and magpies.
That's wow. That's a great description. I'm quite jealous.
Immediately jealous of that.
Thank you.
Thank you. So at the beginning of each of these podcasts, obviously it's an audio format, so we are asking the artist if they could physically describe the object we're focusing on, and for you that's the Rilke translation.
Audley's librarian, pronunciation check.
Hi, this is Jo. Stephen's work is a translation of a novel by Austrian writer Rainer Maria Rilke, the German title of which neither Alice nor I could do justice to. So here's our colleague Dunja with the perfect pronunciation.
Die Aufzeichnungen des Malte Lauritz Brigge von Rainer Maria Rilke.
Thanks, Dunja.
Mm-hmm. Okay, it's a translation of Rilke's only novel, The Notebooks of Malte-Louis Brigge. And it's the German language version, yellow paperback, and it has mushrooms growing from it. And those mushrooms have been dried, desiccated, so that they're preserved in that state. So the book has survived its transition from mere book to mushroom-bearing body.
And I wonder, could you describe for the listeners what it's like to handle and touch now?
Yeah, well, it's surprisingly light. It's quite light because to make it, the book had to be wet, had to be soaked for the spores to grow. And then through the drying process, I'm not sure what the exact process is, but I guess the paper goes through some sort of process which changes the molecules and makes the pages more brittle, I suppose. It loses some of the, maybe it loses more of its water being soaked in water and then being dried somehow, but it feels a lot lighter than it did in the first place. So it's quite delicate. I'm not sure how easy it would be to snap the mushrooms off or anything like that. I think if it was dropped, it would probably break. But yeah, it's quite brittle and delicate. I know about a year after I first dried it out, I was living in London at the time, and the flat there would sometimes get a little bit damp in the corner, and it did start to rehydrate once. This was, you know, quite a few years back. So I had to move it. I think I moved it into the airing cupboard for a little while. So I think it could still, because, well, the mushroom, you could rehydrate the mushroom. It could be rehydrated again, in theory. But hopefully it's no longer spore producing for the sake of all the other books in the library.
That's good to know. Thank you for confirming that.
to interject there, Alice, with her conservation hat on, has quite a terrified expression.
Yeah.
I went through a lot of emotions there, but I'm happy, so that was good. Yeah. And luckily, yeah, in the library, I work in the conservation team, and we are constantly monitoring the environment of all the spaces in the library, so we're hoping we don't have a similar damp patch.
Where is it kept? Is it kept in its own box or something to prevent it?
It's currently on display, actually, in the Western Library, but it's in a plastic box at the moment, and it's also in our quarantine area.
I think the plan was to keep it kind of permanently in quarantine.
Yeah.
Which is...
So we have this quarantine area in the stack, which is a processing area for our team when new objects are brought into the library, particularly things like archives. We have a huge archive collection that come from places that might be a garage or an attic. And we do check these things for mould, damp, pests. So it's actually quite a home in there with...
With the kind of everything else yeah. is in transit while it gets demolded and de-mushroomed. But the translation just kind of stays there in a perpetual state of mushroomness.
Yeah.
So why did you choose this text?
Well, at the time, I was invited by Stephen Fowler, who's a poet who puts on lots of events in London and all over the world, really. But he'd invited me to take part in a series of performances, really, that he was staging over 6 or 7 month period, I think. And I'd always, Rilke was one of the first poets that I got into or that really blew my mind in some way. So I always had this connection to his work. So I went through a period of, I was trying to make translations of all of his work, but I was trying to translate the books rather than the texts. So there was some of his new poems, I think, I translated by, I think I took each of the pages out and I basically made seed bombs out of the pages of that book and distributed them to audience members and asked them to plant the pages so that they would grow flowers. So that was one translation. Another translation I soaked, and then I drank the water, and then I urinated and saved my urine, and that was another translation. And then another one I kind of rotted down in compost, and another one I covered in fat and honey and like grew mold on it. And then I got to this piece and I thought about growing mushrooms on it. So I got a spore kit. And I think it was at one of the final shows for this series that Stephen was putting on that I'd actually made this translation for. And I'd started doing it several weeks beforehand. And when it came to the show, like no mushrooms had grown. I thought it was a complete failure. So I didn't have anything to take. But luckily I'd translated another book. I can't remember which one it was now, but I had something to show and I talked about something else anyway. But I thought it completely failed. So it was about 4 or 5 weeks down the line and it was just this book that was kind of that had been saturated and tied with elastic bands, and it was just sat there on the windowsill and nothing was happening. And I think maybe even a couple of months went by, nothing happened. And then I went to France on holiday to my friend's house, and I took the book there with me, and then the mushroom started growing over there. And then I brought it back, and they grew to the size they are now. And then I kept it on the windowsill a little longer and kept spraying it, hoping that maybe more would grow. But it was starting to get quite sunny, I guess, at this time of the year. And it completely dried out, so it desiccated it, and that preserved the mushrooms. The preservation was kind of accidental to begin with, because I saw it drying out. And then I encouraged it through other means as well and managed to dry it out. Because I'd seen online afterwards, I know that I think there was photographs of some books that had spontaneously grown mushrooms. And there was another artist who had grown magic mushrooms on a book and had a photograph of them. But as objects, they kind of disappeared because they were completely ephemeral because the mushrooms died and disappeared. So what I was really pleased around that this object could be preserved by the drying process and that it was there, you know, for as long as the dried mushrooms will last, I guess.
I also really like your instinct that you're going on holiday, so you have to take your unsuccessful...
I wasn't willing to give up on it, yeah.
Subjectively,
mm-hmm.
I think aesthetically it's a really successful piece. Was that something that was a consideration for you? Did you think about what it would look like?
Mushrooms growing is so organic. How they appeared was kind of...
Uncontrollable.
Absolutely. No, I think so, yeah. I didn't really have any control over it, so I was hoping that they would grow, and I didn't really know what they'd look like or how big they'd get or anything like that. Well, a lot of my work is a sort of controlled chance, so it's like, you know, there's a lot of chance elements involved in something like that, but obviously you're in control to a certain extent, but I like that. I think if the concept's strong enough, then even if it doesn't look very good, then it can still be effective. Do you know what I mean? But I was pleased with the way that they did turn out. Yeah, I think it was a nice sort of array of fruiting.
And so you mentioned there if the concept's strong enough, and you've already mentioned quite a few of your other translation work. What are you trying to explore in these works specifically? The concept of authorship seems to be something that you're questioning, is that right?
To a certain extent, any sort of translation is like an act of destruction in a way, I think, because you're changing a work. Like it always becomes the author's original work, like someone like Tim Atkins, who does lots of very loose translations and just uses the original works as a jumping off point, really, is a good example. But even if somebody's trying to stay as close as they can to the original text, like it's always a completely different animal. So I, yeah, liked the idea of trying to translate the physical body of the book rather than its contents. And I guess, yeah, it does question authorship, but also I'm interested in trying to enter into a dialogue with the materials of the book as well, because the things that books are made of also have like a history as well, from the paper to the glue and the ink. Like it's they're all, you know, part natural, part chemical. And I guess so are the people that write them and make them. So, but I just want to try and get into those areas. But I'm not the sort of artist who sits down and thinks about things philosophically. I don't sit down and kind of write things out what I want to achieve this, that, and the other. I tend to work through things creatively. You know what I mean? I tend to think more in images and things like that. So I'm just working through things. So there's lots of things that don't work out, obviously, but I'm trying to put down in images what I can't discuss in words in some way. I don't know.
So many of your works are about books, the book form. Can you just talk a little bit about what it is about the book form that you are drawn to?
I guess it's because, like many people, I suppose books are a sort of type of magic where you can escape to, sort of as a child, where you start to build your imagination or a place that you can explore things that you couldn't in the real world. And the physical manifestations of those books can also take on a sort of magic, you know, the role of a magical object as well, the touch and the smell, and sometimes just glancing the spine of a book that you have a particular affinity with, sometimes that can bring back all the feeling of that book in some way. I don't always necessarily remember tons of phrases from books, but I tend to end up with a sort of field of images that I relate to that book, and sometimes seeing a book can bring those images back. Or it's not really a nostalgia, but it's some sort of like psychic connection with the book, with the physical object itself. So I guess in transforming, playing or recomposing books, I'm trying to reconnect with that, the magic of it, I suppose.
So kind of bringing the conversation back to the object itself and it being here now in the Bodleian Library's collection, it's obviously incredibly fragile, as you described, and its access in the reading room is restricted, although it is currently exhibited at the moment in the Western, so it is being seen daily but behind glass. Just wondering, when you are making your work, are you conscious of where it will end up? And does it being here, somewhere like the Bodleian now, how do you feel about that? And kind of the ongoing life of your work?
I guess I start thinking about where a work, what will happen to a work, probably after I've made it, mainly because I don't have anywhere to keep them. no, of course, I want to make sure that they're looked after and preserved. I mean, that's all any artist can ask for, really. But yeah, definitely being at the Bodleian is great, is amazing, you know, knowing that it's catalogued there and is being preserved there, and in this case being exhibited there, is, you know, it's fantastic. Yeah, it's brilliant.
Because we obviously also have quite a few of your other works, and the way that a lot of your works question the book form is something that really speaks to a lot of the academics here who use our collections for teaching for so many different reasons.
I've got the impression that, yeah, I think sort of our archivists, I think, tend to like some of the work that I do in vials, that is kind of categorised work in vials, seems to be a hit with archivists in some way.
It makes something light up in our brain for sure.
Yeah.
Whereas then the Mushroom Book got all the conservators kind of like
in it is.
Yeah. And then obviously Endless Sleep appeals to the paper historians.
Yeah, and that's incredibly
dope. Actually, that was something that I wanted to ask you about, because we've got a couple of your unique works here. We've got the Mushroom Book, and we've also got Endless Sleep, which is a, I'm going to say, concrete poem made out of a wasp's nest.
That's right.
But you also create works in unlimited editions. And I'm thinking of things like Poetry Holes and A Box of Ideas. And I, as a curator, would say that they're probably in the tradition of democratic multiples. They're kind of affordable and accessible. Yeah. Is that element of your work important to you, like having things accessible to people?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely, yeah. I really like making work like that. That are available to people, for the price of a regular book kind of thing. It's really important to make those sort of works. I think if you're, if you have work like that, they're going to be seen by more people. Your work's going to get out there, and people have access to something like A Box of Ideas, for instance, which is 56 or 58 cards. They're basically all ideas for conceptual books of poetry. There's that idea, isn't there, that if you just write the concept down, you don't even need to make the thing. If you've got a concept, you just need to write down a piece of paper and give it to somebody and they can look at it. You could just put them up on a wall and they you could say that is the art as well. So I enjoy that aspect of that type of work. But of course, I also like making some objects as well. But yeah, I do like that. Democratic multiples is a great phrase, Joe. I like that. But yeah, I think there was about 100 of those Box of Ideas made. But Poetry Holes, I think James did two different editions. I think there was only maybe 30 of those made in over both editions, I think. So there's not many of those. But that seems to be work that people... I know a few people who work in creative writing, at universities, and a few of them seem to use that when they're talking about form, because you know, for anyone who doesn't know, they're A5 rectangles. The first edition was PVC, the second was wood, and they have shapes of poems cut out of them, like one is just a rectangle, so you can lay it over any text and it will create a poem. So they're basically cutouts of form, and you can just create a text using that. And I did a sort of inverse of that called cover-ups, which were acetate with black shapes on that you lay over text, and then it blocks out large portions of the text, which was also a multiple. And yeah, I like the idea of people being able to play with the work. That's another instance. That's something that's performative, but then I'm giving it, or somebody's buying that, or I'm giving it to them, but they're making the performance because it comes with a brief set of instructions. But then it's up to you, and you're performing that work and creating something out of it. So for quite a while, I know I went through a period. I suppose maybe I still work in that way now, a little, trying to make poems without any words at all, and somehow just having a brief set of instructions so that other people can make the poem, but they would still be mine somehow. If P Then Q published a book called Family Portraits, mine as well, which is it's a hardback book with it's several different chapters. Each chapter has, I think, 8 or 9 portrait shaped rectangles in them, and it comes with a packet of lactose pills, placebo pills, and you take a pill for each chapter, and taking the placebo is said to allow you to see the portraits. So then that's like another instance of the reader being the performer. So I'm a reluctant performer, so I'm trying to give my performing duties away.
Really interesting interaction with the reader at that point. That's a couple of other of the artists we've interviewed for the series have talked about their objects and books possibly are still changing in a way that yours hopefully isn't. But they kind of see the reader as actively involved in changing and the continued life of their works.
Yeah.
Which is sounds like, yeah.
Yeah, co-authorship. There's definitely a co-authorship theme coming through. Yeah.
I have another question as a conservator for you, which I'd be very interested to hear what you think. How would you feel about future intervention if it was needed with this piece by my team? So, I don't know. If a mushroom fell off, how would you feel? Would you have an opinion on what we did?
I might have an opinion, but I guess you guys will probably know better than I. But I guess it could be glowed on. I did think about using a varnish on it at one point, using a clear matte PVC varnish on the whole thing to like encase it. But I didn't know if that might have had an adverse effect, so I didn't do it, which would have might have protected it a little bit more. But I'd be very pleased if it needed repairs and you or somebody else repaired it.
I have to say, we don't have any other books like this, so it would still be us kind of working it out. But as I said, preservation and safe handling is our number one goal at the moment.
Yes, no, of course.
Keeping it kind of as it is. I just wanted to ask, because I was interested if you did have any other, I don't know, you could have said grow another mushroom on it, which I'm glad you didn't say that.
No, yes.
So, last question. Steve, what's next?
Okay. I just finished writing a big long prose poem, which is a sort of abstract lyric prose poem. And I've been working for quite a while now. I haven't made them available yet, but I've been working a lot on these overwrites. So I'm I did a set of four just after lockdown. It was Ovid's Black Sea letters, which he wrote when he was sent out to the Black Sea region, when he offended the emperor. He was kind of sent to Coventry, as it were. So I did an overwrite. So it's made up of four books. So I wrote the entirety of book one on a piece of paper over itself, using different grades of pencils and sometimes using China white markers, which gives you a nice texture. So I did a slightly different shape of overwrite for each book. Fourth one is kind of like a grid that feels the whole one. So it basically turns the text into a sort of abstract visual script in some way. I've been working on quite a lot of those. I've done some with poems and some with Beckett's plays. So I've been doing these overwrites. Some of them are quite big, some of them are quite small, and they're making interesting shapes, I think. I'm quite pleased with them. And I'm also erasing a book. I'm erasing a book at the moment called Human Memory. I've got this an old paperback book from the 70s. I think it was an old series of books on psychology. I don't know if it's published by Penguin, I can't remember who. It's about 100 pages long, so I've been erasing it with like a fine grit sandpaper, and I'm keeping all the erased shavings in a big scientific jar. But it's taking ages to do. So
you're gonna do the whole thing?
Yeah, I'm gonna do the whole thing. Oh, it's a sort of, I wish I'd never started it, because it's going to take ages.
Lovely. Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Jo. Thanks, Alice. It's been wonderful. Thank you. I really appreciate you asking me to come and talk to you. It's been great.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Bookness. You can find photos of translation over on the Conveyor blog, and you still have a few weeks to see it on display in the Sensational Books exhibition here in Oxford before the exhibition closes on the 4th of December 2022.
Join us next time for our final episode in the series, when we'll be talking to Justine Provino about her research into self-destructing artists' book, Agrippa, A Book of the Dead. See you then.
Have you got a jingle for the podcast?
We haven't got a jingle. There's a jingle. We've got hubbub.
Oh, yeah. Excellent.
Do you want to provide a jingle?
Yeah, was that an offer?
Oh, no, no, no.
Obviously, a library is quite a quiet place. So we've been trying to think of like audio things that we can shoehorn into the podcast format. It has been quite...
We should do a shh.
Yes, that'd be good.
Is that too cheesy?
Yes, too cheesy.
You could do a sort of sound piece with different lots of different shushes.
Or we could just record the reading room, which is just silence.
Yes.